I spent actually about 7 weeks in Thailand on an island called Phuket, which is in southern Thailand. It was a kind of a beach that you'd expect Dorothy Lamour to swim out from behind a rock, and it had that quality. It looked like a movie set, and it was perfect for the work I needed. There was hardly anybody there, and I could write and be alone and swim for hours, and that's just the kind of thing I like to do, and eat in outdoor restaurants and stuff. Live in a bathing suit, pretty much. And later on, I was back in Bangkok on my way to Maui, I guess, and I met Joseph Goldstein and Jack Kornfield and their entourage, and they were going up to Achin Chah's monastery in northern Thailand. And he is one of the teachers of Jack, and he's a extraordinarily beautiful, very, very high Vipassana master, Theravadan Buddhist master. And we visited his monastery, and I really honored him. He's an older man, maybe 70, I don't know. I don't exactly know that, but he has the lightness and delight. And yet his form is very pukka, his form is very exquisite. And that was quite beautiful to me. That because usually somebody that light is pretty formless, but that he could be really tough with his students and a good master, teacher, without a heavy way that he clung to it. It taught me a lot. I really learned about the beauty of that dance from him. And they have a Western monastery near there where the Western have started it. They have a Western abbot from England, and I don't know, 8 or 10 Westerners there, I guess. And we walked through the jungle on the begging rounds, 4 or 5 in the morning, when all the villagers come out and put rice, this kind of gooey, sticky rice, into their bowls. And the silent early morning walk through these little villages along these footpaths with the pigs and the goats and the dogs and the babies and the women standing by the side of the road kneeling, holding these covered baskets. And then as the monk comes, he doesn't even look at them. He just walks along with his bowl, his big bowl, and then he stops, and then she puts something in, and then he just goes on. And it was quite, you could feel how long these paths had been tread, and the humility and the perfection that everybody was getting what they needed. The monks needed the food, the villagers needed what might be called merit on a gross level, but really just the participation in a spiritual process. And of course it's very delicate because the prognosis is not too good for those areas because the Chinese, the communist country, it's surrounded by communist countries, and there's a lot of border incidents all the time. And I heard one story about I think this was a historical story, I don't think it's a recent story, of a group of invaders who were coming and killing all the monks, because that's what the communists often do, they kill the monks in the monasteries. And they were killing all the monks in these monasteries, and most of the monks in this one monastery fled to the hills, except for one monk, the abbot. And there was one leader of the invasion who was very, very violent man, and who killed ruthlessly, and like Genghis Khan, I guess. And he heard that this monk had not left, and he came in and he came up to the monk and he said, "Don't you know who I am? I can kill a man without batting an eye." And the monk said, "Don't you know who I am? I can be killed without batting an eye." And the invader bowed and walked away. And I get a feeling that they understand that story there, that there's a great confrontation at the highest level of being in that issue, you know. And I have a feeling that in Tibet there was a lot of that too. So that was a good visit up there by overnight railway to Achin Chah's place. Then I met this, I had met her before just briefly, but I had a lovely time with this Josie Stanton. Josie is she's probably in her 60s, I'd say. She's a real swinger. Her husband used to be the ambassador to Thailand, the U.S. ambassador to Thailand. He died. She continues to live maybe 6 months of the year there, and she takes care of all of the Westerners that get in the trouble, right? And she's seen by the embassy as both a Florence Nightingale and a total drag, because she's always bugging everybody about everything, but she's very close to everybody, all the ambassador and his wife and all that stuff. The ambassador's wife in Thailand, by the way, is a great devotee of Muktananda's and has built a house in Ganeshpuri, okay? So, Josie said, I want to take you down to this monastery to show you this monastery. And she took me to a monastery about 2 hours south of Thailand. We stopped at a women's prison first to visit some inmates, and that was a great trip. And then we went on to this monastery, and this is a monastery in which they heal heroin addicts. And they heal 300 heroin addicts every 10 days, okay? And it costs $15 a heroin addict. Okay? This stuff is so far out that it's very hard to even grasp this, okay? And there indeed are the rooms in which these people are lying on pallets along the walls, maybe 100 in a room. And there are the one-dayers and the two-dayers and the three-dayers, and the one-dayers are shaking and vomiting, and they really look like the worst kind of junk addicts. And then by the seventh or eighth day, they start to be straight and clear, and they're walking around smoking and talking. There are baths and showers, and there's an herbal thing they drink, a diuretic, where they vomit a great deal. And the whole place is very funky, but very strong, very powerful. And I met the abbot, who is this guy. He's like an oak tree, and he's about, I'd say maybe about 35, 40, it's hard to tell. So, his story is, I heard about him from Josie. He was with the narcs of Thailand. He was a narc and narcotics inspector. And his aunt was a Buddhist saint, and which is a rare thing anyway. She had all these powers, and she said to him, "Why are you so involved with violence and hurting these people? Why don't you help them instead?" And he said, "Well, I don't know how to help them." And she said, "Well, you get yourself straight and I'll show you." So he quit the Narcotics Bureau and he became a Theravadan Buddhist monk, which has 218 precepts, right? Of you can't do anything, I mean, but nothing. And not only does he do the 218, but he's added 10 more, all right? He's a breakaway sect because the other sects were too wild, and so he's added 10 more, so he's got 228 precepts, okay? And you meet him, and it's like meeting, it's just solid all the way through. Whatever he is, he sure is, right? So I said to him, and he's a beautiful guy, a very warm, smiling guy, but tough. And I said to him, and the statistics that they report say that 70% of the people remain off heroin, right? Which is very impressive for $15, you know, compared to what the U.S. spends, you know, and how little luck it has. So I said to him, is what you're doing unique to you, or could it ever be done anywhere else by anybody else? Is it just this place, by you? Because if it is, it's lovely, but just a passing, it's not terribly interesting, yeah. And he said, no. He said, it could be done by someone else. I said, well, what kind of a person would that be? So I don't have the tape of what this was, and I wish I did because my memory distorts terribly, but he said something to the effect that if you went up into the mountains and you had a blanket and it was cold and you decided that blanket would be enough, and then somebody came along and offered you another blanket, would you take it? So then everybody waited for me to come through with the decision, so I thought about that and I said no. So why not? I said, well, I already have a blanket. I said, it's like if I were fasting, I decide I'm going to fast and somebody offers me food, I may be hungry, but I don't take the food. If I decided the blanket was enough, it's enough. He said, fine. He said, but they leave the blanket anyway. And they go away, and then you go out to pee, and it snows. And it snows on your blanket, and you come back. Will you use the other blanket? So I said, of course I will. I said, I only said I had a blanket. I didn't say I have my blanket, and now I don't have a blanket, and there's a blanket, so I'll use it. He says, no. I said, no? Why not? It seems reasonable to me. No. And the tenor of the way he gave me this about 2-hour oral examination was that when you get to the point where the way you say it is the way it is, with no qualifications whatsoever and no bending at all, then you could play this game. He says to these people when they come, you will be here for 10 days, you may never come here again. Right? And they take something which is like the vows of Alcoholics Anonymous, sort of. But the level he does it is like the level at which truth is spoken. Right? And the power of that truth, I just hadn't ever seen somebody who was so totally one as a karma yogi. I mean, he is the yoga part of karma yoga, right? And we do karma yoga in such a schlock way in the West that to see this kind of being who has surrendered in so that the word and he are the same thing, and the service and he and the word are the same thing, and it's all one thing. And then you begin to sense that power.
Does he say you may never come again, or you will never come again, in a sense of like you can't come again, or like
no, you may not. No, you may not. He doesn't do you will not. No, you may not.
No, you may not.
You may not. He merely defined. What I gathered was, when I thought about it afterwards, I thought, well, alcoholism is a strong addiction or habit or physiological habit. But what is stronger is somebody who has given up alcohol, their belief system, and therefore AA works, because it's done really by people who've given it up, being around people who haven't given it up. But that doesn't work with junkies, because this power of junk is too strong. It really is. It's too powerful for most of the methods we have in the West. And all I saw was that the power of the spirit was stronger. The power of this guy, and I call it the power of the spirit, was stronger than the junkie's addiction to junk. And when this guy defined another reality, his definition was stronger than their definition was. Right? And that's his 228 precepts working. That's why in all of the systems, like Ashtanga Yoga and all in Theravadan Buddhism, it's Sila before Panya and Samadhi, meaning purification. In Ashtanga Yoga, it's Yama and Niyama before the other six parts of it. It's always the purification first. And there's where the power comes, from the austerities, from the tapasya, from the discipline, from the renunciation, you know. And he was a statement of that. I'd never seen a statement that strong. So I said to him, could you train me to do it? He looked at me and said, well, if we cleaned up a few loose edges, I think you might work. When I came back, I thought about, like, I'd like to send some junkies over there to run through the program to see what they look like afterwards. I'd like to send somebody over to train with him. But A, I couldn't find any junkies that could get through Bangkok, since it's the Golden Triangle, without getting lost in the fact that you can get junk for 25 cents. And I couldn't find anybody who was disciplined enough in karma yoga, ready to surrender to the level he would demand for that game to be transmitted. So on behalf of the Hanuman Foundation, they were broke. They're completely out of money. They were $3,000 in debt, so I gave him $3,000. Right? He immediately asked for twice as much. They used that money, and as far as I know, they've closed since then because they had no money. And they'll open again, I'm sure. But Josie said she'd taken congressmen there. She's taken people from the networks. She's taken people from the Drug Administration. And they all are totally confused. They don't understand it. Because of course not. Because it's this herbal... The aunt gave him this herbal concoction, which is a diuretic of some sort, plus this vow business. And the thing together has a power that does it. It's a very powerful diuretic, though. You know, really. The vomiting is very intense. There are all these photographs of people vomiting. I mean, they vomit all together every day, and they carry the pail around for each other, and they all drink it and vomit. I mean, that's far out, it seems. It's a strong scene, you know.
Well, it sounds as though what he's doing is forcing that living in the moment, first of all. I find myself, while you were saying that, if I am listening to a radio program and taping it at the same time, I find I listen less.
Yeah.
Because I always have that, well, I can listen to it later.
Yes. Yes, exactly. Right on. Right on, yeah. He's making it valuable. He's making it important.
Yeah.
And then he's creating a space that is so strong that they don't think, he doesn't see them as junkies. They're just people that have...
And the other aspect is that very strong sense of the discipline of decision, which carries through a great many disciplines.
Yeah.
It is a technique in a great many spiritual paths on the path.
The only thing is, it's where it's done from.
Yeah.
You know, that you can do all the austerities and do them from such a horrible place that they are just, you just end up a kind of a moralistic, righteous prig, you know. You can do it from another place where it's just a natural flow.
What does happen when you achieve what you set out to do with that sense of decision? If you don't have a sense of pride in having done it, how do you surrender
just become,
it up?
You become like a piece of steel. You just become...
It's a tempering process?
It's a process it's a kind of a strength. It's not an ego strength. It's not that you say, I have this strength. You just are strong. It's like somebody's body that is just beautifully, it's like a karate master or something like that, where you just feel the power of the body. It's not them thinking about it. It's just,
and it's really assimilated into your being.
Like a tiger or a lion or something like that. Yeah, it's like more like a tiger or a lion.
Because very often people will go through it and they'll be very proud at having accomplished it.
That's the failure of most Siddha yoga, is that everybody gets on an ego trip about it.
And the other extreme is of surrendering it up with enormous gratitude, and it doesn't feel as though that's it either. But what you're talking about is that tempering, that
it's just
assimilation,
doing it. It's just doing
absorption
it.
Into...
There is hardly a hatha yogi that isn't on an ego trip somewhere.
Mm.
And there is hardly anybody that's a siddha yoga that doesn't get caught. Because the powers are great, and to the extent there's any ego left, it's a tremendously dangerous path. Really a dangerous path.
Sounds like you're talking from experience.
Well, I've certainly seen a lot of people get caught. I've certainly seen that. And
in the past, you've very often spoken of the danger of phenomena, and yet you rather got caught yourself with the phenomena surrounding Jaya. And I was wondering how do you feel that really happened?
How did I get caught in Jaya?
How'd you get caught?
How'd you get caught? Haven't I written all that? Didn't I write all
the
that?
Last time
didn't I write a thing called Egg on My Beard?
Yeah, yes, but frankly, my reaction to that was that, justly or unjustly, was that you were taking yourself too seriously and not acknowledging the real, what you really have to give people, and that's pulling the carpet out from under them periodically. So that they don't get trapped into anything by changing course, by changing the rules of the game, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's your...
That may be me as a teaching, but it isn't necessarily me as a teacher.
Right, yeah.
Right. And I mean, in terms of my experience, one thing is my experience of why I think I got caught. The effect of getting caught may have been great for everybody else. It was great for me, by the way. I mean, I have nothing but appreciation for the forces of the universe that allowed me to have that experience. You know, I also am perfectly comfortable to be done with it, right? And I certainly don't want to go back into it, right? Not out of negation, but just because I'm done with it. Just like I'm done with a lot of other trips I've been on. How did I get caught in it? I got caught in it by my own sense of unworthiness. That was the thing that got me into it, really. That makes me vulnerable. It's an attachment to a set of thoughts about who I'm not, which constantly leads me again and again to a feeling of being caught in hypocrisy, of appearing to be something I'm not. I mean, it's my impurity. It's that, it's a karmic thing in me, right? And in large part, it was really focused around the sexuality, you know, because here was Maharaji, who was, as close as I could see, just a free being, really free. And here I had obviously received his grace and his blessings. And it was also clear that an awful lot of people were being touched by this process through which I was passing, that were getting off through me. And there was a yearning in me to be a pure vehicle for the transmission, a very powerful yearning. But the ways in which I was impure, I couldn't get leverage on. And one of them was the sexual one. Now, the sexual one wasn't bothering me in the lust sense so much, because I have lust, and it's still there, and it still can arise. But it's something that I can see it for what it is. What bothered me was whether my sexual pathology, which was my homosexuality primarily, was distorting something very subtly in everything I was doing, such that I was there was a karmic burden involved in the process. Not in the gross sense, but if it's like this, the issue of whether school teachers that are homosexual should be teaching high school kids or junior high school kids is a very interesting issue. Do you know? Because whether there is imprinting or identification, and I mean, Freud talks about at the time of puberty and the onset of puberty, there's a reprocess of availability and openness and identification. And if, although I don't really understand about homosexuality well enough to know whether it is a process of identification or how much it's a process of endocrinology, which it may well just simply be, you know, on which the whole psychological thing is built. I don't know whether it's psychogenic or somatogenic, really. But if there was a chance, because I realized from my LSD experiences, when I would set aside all of my conceptual structures, of which homosexuality was one of them, and during LSD periods, I was as heterosexual as you come, okay? Wasn't a doubt about it. And so I experienced being other than what I would keep coming back into all the time. All right? Can you hear what the issue is? Now I'm faced with the fact that this thing is holding on and I don't know how to get free of it. Right? I can meditate and it's irrelevant, and it's irrelevant most of the time, but when it's relevant, how do I know that the way it's relevant isn't subtly affecting my teachings? If I say to somebody, be celibate, maybe it's easy for me to be celibate because my sexual objects are unavailable in the society to me. While it's very different for somebody who doesn't, who has where the society is totally reinforcing their sexual expression. Right? And what am I to say about marriage? And what am I to, you know, like I didn't want to sort of let this distortion hurt other people, and I couldn't figure out how to get rid of it. Okay? Do you hear the predicament? Now, I've tried everything. I've tried acting out, I've tried repression, I've tried offering, I've tried pujas, I've done the whole shtick. I mean, for years I've done the whole thing. And I finally figured, well, that's going to be the thing this lifetime. I mean, I'm just going to be stuck with that this lifetime. There's no way out, all right? And therefore, my teachings are always going to be a little off-center, and there's nothing I can do about it. And it's Maharaji's grace that it's as good as it is, and it'll help people, and then they will have to go on somewhere else because I can't get in deeper to this. And along comes, because in my readings, I'm always coming across the Tibetan tantric exercises in which the monk meets a dakini who has been trained since she's like 2 years old, a temple dakini, to take the monk through the sexual exercises as a pure spiritual exercise in which there is no attachment on her part, no lust on her part, and she awakens the whole process. They eat a cardamom seed first, and the whole arousal process goes on, and it's a very delicate process, and then it's taken up the chakras and up into the head, and then he releases that sexual energy and moves it into the higher chakras. Okay? And I read about it. Who would expect you'd have a chance to practice it? Okay, where am I going to find it? Tibet's closed, and I kept looking in India, and I didn't find anybody, you know. So, and every woman I knew was so full of attachment and desire, and there wasn't a chance, you know. So then I meet this woman by a peculiar set of circumstances, which have been duly reported, in which, and during which, she says to me, in our initial few months, of where I'm in New Hampshire and she's talking to me on the phone, she says to me, in effect, I have come to Earth specifically to release you from this thing that you're stuck in. Right? That's what I'm here for. Okay? I have no feeling in my body at all. I'm dead to the world, she's saying. I am here only for this purpose. Okay? Do you hear that? You hear how that fit in with my fantasy?
Oh, yes.
With my desire that I had given up. That's the seduction of the scene. That's what got me into it. Okay? And it took me a year and a half to get what I could on that dimension out, begin to realize that I was indeed quite free of the whole business in one way that would, in which I stopped being frightened that it was going to affect my teachings, and then see that here was a woman with much attachment, and then go away. And that took a year and a half.
Thank you.
It's a great story. I mean, it's very powerful. It's a beautiful one, you know. And there were some really, really heavy, well, there was a lot of heavy moments in it. It was an incredible process, incredible process. But there were moments that I feel that I did a karmic thing that was wrong. Not in taking the teachings. But see, I got caught in the position of having two interesting things. When you are in the role of being a vehicle for transmission for others, you could call it a teacher or a teaching, you have certain moral responsibilities. And when you are a student and you have a teacher, you have certain requirements. And when those things go together, it's perfect. When they are opposed, what do you do? See? And there, I faced the predicament when I was giving the interview for the New Age Journal. And Eric Utney, I believe, said to me, do you think that she is an enlightened being, a realized being? Right? And at that moment, I remember it very vividly. My heart said, no, not a chance. But I was in a teaching with this woman, and the rules of the teaching are, and the rules she demanded were, surrender. And she said to me, quote, I am an enlightened being, right, unquote. And therefore, for me to say no, ended the teaching right there. That was as simple as that. However, for me to say no was the morally responsible thing to do for the people that subsequently went to her based on my saying that. Okay? That's karma on my head. All right? Can you hear that one? But the karma was in... Well, I took on the karma. I didn't do it. I mean, I'm not... It wasn't the right thing to do, by the way. I think I made a mistake. But I took it on because I placed my getting the teachings above my responsibility as a teacher, because I felt that it was only if I got the teachings that I could become a true teacher. So it's a very interesting issue. I mean, I really loved it as an issue. You know, I'm sorry about the karma of it, but I love it as an issue.
Ram Dass, I was telling someone that we were going to be interviewing you this afternoon. This person said, well, you know, everybody knows what Ram Dass has been into. What's he into now? What's new? What's he doing now? What are you doing now?
Well, you heard that I'm giving a lecture tour next spring, and what it's labeled, it's titled Nothing New by Nobody Special. Because I'm tired of coming up with new things all the time, okay? And the newest thing is that nothing's new, right? I am, now that I've said that, I'll tell you what's new. In India last winter, I spent 12 weeks traveling from village to village, collecting stories. It just turned out that while 3 years ago when Maharaji was in his body, none of the Indians would talk about Maharaji. They'd talk about him, but they'd never tell stories about him. Now, for some reason, to me, that reason's always Maharaji, they couldn't get to me fast enough to tell stories. They were delighted to share stories. And I realized I was sitting on an absolute gold mine here of stories, and so I started to go around with translators and so on, tape recorder, and I'd sit in hotel rooms and type at night. And I really worked with Chaitanya, this friend of mine. We just worked full blast for 12 weeks till I ended up with 1,200 stories. We had 400 before, so now we have 1,600 stories of Maharaji. The most extraordinary stories. I mean, just mind-blowing. And then I went off to that island in Thailand to figure out what to do with them. Right? And the problem was that no matter how, it's hard to conceive of 1,200 units of information and figure out what to do with them, because they don't fall, it's not easy to organize material. So if you try to build it around a person, like these are all stories about Maharaj, about a person, they don't go together. They don't make up a person. And as one of them said, that one of the Indian devotees said very succinctly, there are no stories about Maharaji. We were merely present when certain events occurred. And I really see this as just a series, because there's nobody in there. And yet it's very hard to write biography about, because you project into a person when you're writing biography motives and attitudes and perceptions, but you can't do that. You can't say he did this because of this, because you don't know that, right? So I wrestled with this, with charts on the walls and all kinds of stuff to try to figure out what the hell to do with all this. And then as an exercise, I started to review the 10 years I had been with Maharaji, because this November, about a couple of weeks, is the 10th anniversary of my meeting Maharaji, in terms of how my perception of who he was had changed over the 10-year period. And started, because all these stories, I had heard stories like them along the way, and they had affected what I thought he was, right? So that I went from the first meeting where I think I'm dealing with another person like you and I, to 10 years later where my whole dialogue in the universe is with him, and all my experiences, it's like I'm Charlie McCarthy, you know, and he's Edgar Bergen in a way, you know. I mean, I just feel like I'm being taken through a process. And I realized as I went on and I started to weave the stories into that 10-year chronology, and I began to see that it was a beautiful chance to explore what the relationship with Guru is about in terms of a Westerner's perception of that shifting process, and that the quality of devotional yoga that's involved is very rarely dealt with in the West. The West's concept of devotional yoga isn't this thing at all. It's a very, very subtle process, and the book, in fact, is titled with a line from the Kabir the poet. The title of the book is Subtle as the Path of Love. And it really is a weaving of these stories and this chronology. To, in a way, it's interesting because it's like going back into personal history again. But it's very from a whole, just in from the point of view of my relation with him. But like Joya comes in relation to as if he gave her to me as part of a process, just like we were talking about before. That's the function of Joya in the book, right? Chogyam Trungpa, Muktananda, Haridas Baba, all these people entered into my consciousness as part of a dialogue with my guru, right? Until finally the universe becomes the guru, including you, and then God, Guru, and Self become one. I mean, it's a very clear process. And since I've been going through it, it's a great thing to stand back and see how that process has been, how it works. Right? So I'm in the middle of that book, And this is the first book I've ever written, right, which is a great new experience for me, because every book has always been tapes of lectures. Because every time I'd sit down at a typewriter, I'd turn back into a Harvard professor. And the article would come out like Journal of Abnormal and Social Psychology, right? Because I was so well trained. And this is the first time. But what I've got to do is I can't be around other human beings when I do it. I go off by myself, and after a week, I start to get into these ecstasy states where I'm just like, especially when I'm with the ocean or something like that, I just start to just float away. And then I sit down, and the stuff just pours out. And in something like about 4 weeks, let's see, in about 2.5 weeks, I wrote 250 pages of what is really like finished manuscript. It just poured out of me. And now I'm making it, I'm going back and reweaving and all this kind of stuff, and I hope to finish it by spring. So I'm going off to Spain, I think, a few weeks, hole up in a remote house by the ocean, and I'm just going to write for several months. Then I'm going to spend a month with my father, probably in Greece, because we spent a month in Martha's Vineyard this summer, and we'll spend a month together. That's fun. Then I'm coming back, and I'm going back full blast into public stuff. Going on a heavy tour in April and a heavy tour in May. Teaching at Lama in June. Teaching with Sasaki Roshi at Mount Baldy in July. Running a seminar on dying, 2-week seminar on dying with Steve Levine in August or September. Going back on the road, I'm just going to really just start the cycle again, right? And then just do that until whatever happens next, I don't know. And, yeah. Thoughts about that?
No, I'm pleased.
I can experience the way I act very spiral, very much as a spiral, where I go out and then I turn inward, and I go out and turn inward. And this year, since Joya, and now another winter, is all the turning inward. And out of the inward turning comes this book. And then the outward turning is the teaching and guiding and relating to people and so on. And it's just beautiful, because I know, and I've been watching the progress in this transformation, and I am, it is no doubt, it's emptier, lighter, clearer. You know, I'm watching the effects. I watch how I play with things like fame and money and power and sex and greed and all these things, and I'm watching this transformation and seeing an inevitability. And Maharaji saying to me, if you give up money, women and gold, you know, sex and common conscience, you will know God. And I see the inevitability and the irrevocability of the whole thing, and it's just like it's greased wheels, you know, you're just kind of sliding into this thing. And being with Kalu in Santa Fe a few weeks ago, when I said to Kalu, we were talking about guru and transmission, he said, for people to have a vehicle for transmission is very important in a lifetime. He didn't say quite that way, but roughly that. And I realized that Maharaji did give a transmission. I mean, there's something that transpired between Maharaji and me such that the way I am with other human beings allows them to touch places in themselves that releases a process that starts them going. If you just listen to the telephone calls on the radio, meet people in the street, hear, be here now, change my life, your tapes change my life. It's not me, obviously, it's this thing that touches them. If it does come through, I really have no right to stop its flow. I really don't have any right to do that. And the reason I was doing it was pandering to my own feeling of unworthiness. And I don't really have a right to do that anymore. So what I'm feeling is, okay, I'll just keep doing it and just keep wrestling with my impurities along the way, because that's just my problem. But in the meantime, other beings can keep, you know, I'd like to just do it and do it. I'd like to do it on public television. I'd like to, you know, I'd really like to have a television show. That's what I'd like to have. I like to, every week for a half hour, I like to take non-prime time, and I'd like to take their public service, you know, commitment and non-prime time, and I'll pay them for the tithe. I'll be the sponsor. I'll raise the money independently. Give them the shows. I've got to do the shows the way I've got to do them. They've got to be very low-key, and they've got to be just like this, and very straight. And let the audience build, and just do, say, six pilots, and then let the thing, because I think in just a half an hour, it could be in the middle of the night on Thursday. It doesn't have to be any special time at all.
You may have it sooner than you think. It's very much...
It's a tricky
much
thing.
Much there.
It's tricky, though, you see, because the media... My little media app. The media is so much got a model about what reality is and its own position in it that you can feel as you approach the media how you slowly get seduced into this model of who the audience is and who the sponsors and who the management are and who's the keeper of the trust of television and, you know, who's exploiting and all that. These are all models. And I don't have those models. And I don't want to have those models, right? And it's very interesting because the models are so homogeneous within the television industry that there's hardly entry into it. You can get in, say, on cable TV or something like that, but there's hardly entree otherwise into it. And if you, I can watch the subtle suggestions about, well, about a script, about how much people have to be entertained, about how much visuals you'll have to entertain people, about how it has to move, about how you've got to, you know, you know it all as well as I do, you know. And to me, that's all baloney. I mean, out there are a lot of beings that are me, and I know that the media is just waiting for people to be straight, to use it straight, so that when you're looking at the eye of the camera, you're really looking at it. You're not looking at the cue card right above it, you know, so that your eyes are like 1 millisecond off, and you're looking like you're looking at people, and you're not looking at them. Right, and I think that there is hardly a person who can work with television who will look at a camera and not go through a trip as a result of it being a camera and then being on television. And to me, that's a sadhana, to look at the television and see the lens as the eye, the third eye of another being, and talk directly to that being. And then it comes interesting because the person that's running the television camera, their consciousness starts to be interwoven, and you're dealing with a union man who's doing it, you're a side of beef, and they're doing it like they see you as an image. They don't hear a word you're saying and nothing. It's just a thing with a red light and stuff in their box. And that's impossible. So you got to have your own crew. And you got to do it. How do you know that you're going to be in the space to do it when at $1,000 a minute or whatever the damn thing is for 2-inch television, you're ready, and you can't, a studio and the vibrations are so horrible, and forget it, I won't even play. When I had some friends that said, we'll put up some money, so you're going to rent 2-inch equipment for a day at whatever it's going to cost, I don't know, $1,600 or whatever, maybe more than that, and maybe I won't feel like doing it, right? And so that'll be that day blown. And there's a crew and training the crew. You know, it's a big production. And I just am waiting for it to happen rather than trying to make it. I keep, because it would make the whole job so much easier because it would use the media in a proper way and it would allow, the traveling is very heavy, by the way. The traveling is really, finally, just to keep a quiet space when you're going from motel to airplane and so on. The way I'm designing the tour this spring is going to be fun. Jai Gopal, do you know Jai Gopal? He's a very beautiful musician. And Jai and I are going to work together. And we're going to, and this friend of mine, Dean in Santa Cruz, is going to organize the tour. And I'm going to... We're going to work with having the whole tour as a sadhana, where we have silence between gigs. We do a gig every night. And all the rest of the time is just a completely, we stay right in it. The food we take, I've always gone it alone, from motel to airplane. Now we're going to do it entirely differently.